How many of us, I like to start with a question, because it puts you on edge right away, doesn't it? How many of us like to tune into the Antiques Roadshow on a Sunday evening? I knew there would be at least a few of you, and there'll be a few going, I'll not admit to that. Antiques Roadshow, I can't remember if it comes on just before Songs of Praise on a Sunday night. If you are one of those that likes to tune in to the Antiques Roadshow, then you are just but one of about 6 million others. The Antiques Roadshow has attracted audiences now for over 30 years, screening over 500 programmes. And in that time, it's only had something like 4 different presenters. And whenever the news goes out that the Antiques Roadshow is going to be coming to a particular town or city, then folks will climb up into the loft, go down into the cellar, rummage around and see what they can find, and then go and queue, quite often in excess of 5 hours, in order to see and talk to one of the experts. What is it, do you think, that makes the Antiques Roadshow so popular? I think for some, it might be that opportunity to have their 5 minutes, or 20 seconds of fame on the telly. For others, it might simply be the chance just to show off. Look what I've got, Gainsborough. But for some, it might be a real desire to find out a little bit more about the history of this particular relic that they might have within their family. But for many, I really think it's the hope that when they're standing there beside that expert, he's going to utter those few wee magic words. And you know what they are, don't you? If this were to be sold at auction, you should expect it to receive several thousands of pounds. Yummy! Now, I have to admit that when I see some of the stuff that they put up in front of the experts on the Antiques Roadshow, to me it just looks like a pile of junk. A stuff that I would have thrown out years ago. But often that junk, the stuff that looks bashed, dirty, mismatched, is often the stuff that the experts get all excited about. That's the stuff that they would sell at auction for a lot of money. That is the stuff that to them will have the highest value. Now, those of you who were here 2 weeks ago might remember that I asked us the question, what does the church look like to those who are round about us? But now I want to go a little bit deeper into that. Now I want us to think about what we as individuals look like to those round about us, both within the church family and outside. Are we seen as being potentially of great worth, of great value? Or are we seen as being rather tired? Like myself, perhaps rather scruffy. Tired. Worthless bits of junk. And if you also remember from a couple of weeks ago, I spoke about fanaticism within religious movements or political organizations, and the fanatic's intolerance of anyone that doesn't think as they do. And in the Bible we have in the New Testament, we have this wonderful example within the Pharisees of these fanatics. They couldn't tolerate people who didn't think the same way that they did, who didn't follow their religion the same way that they did. Rather than thinking of God as a God who loved and cared for his people, they actually looked forward to the destruction and to the total obliteration of the sinner. And it was against this mindset that Jesus went to great lengths to try to let people know that this is not what the relationship between God and humanity is supposed to be like. So much so that this morning from Luke's Gospel, we read two parables, one hard on the heels of the other, that to many of us, when we just read through it, seem to be saying exactly the same thing. Now, you won't have noticed this, I'm quite sure, but it's a common trick in public speaking to repeat a point that you wish to make. To repeat a point that you want to make. And by doing so, the chances are that the part of the audience that's unwrapping its sweeties or perhaps nodding off when you make the point the first time will catch it the second time round. And perhaps that's why ministers like to repeat themselves so often. What we have before us this morning is not just a part of the gospel, but according to Willie Barclay, is very probably a gospel within the gospel. It's Jesus teaching us through a couple of parables what the relationship between God and his people is really like. But before we actually look at the contents of those two parables themselves, I want to spend just a couple of moments on the opening verses of Luke chapter 15. Because those two verses, or two or three verses, tell us so much about the relationship between Jesus and the Pharisees and between Jesus and the common, ordinary people. Now, the tax collectors, and I love this bit, and the tax collectors and sinners. In my New International Version, the word sinners is in quotes. We're all gathering round to hear him. But the Pharisees and the teachers of the law muttered, "This man welcomes sinners and eats with them." Now, we're all familiar, I am sure, with the images of Jesus standing in front of large crowds or surrounded by large crowds as he preached to them. But in this particular instance, Luke's not talking about large crowds. He doesn't mention large crowds. Luke, in this particular occasion, mentions quite specifically the tax collectors and the sinners were gathering round to hear him. Anyone who didn't live according to the way that the Pharisees and the teachers of the law thought that they should was branded a sinner. The tax collectors were bundled into this group as well. Tax collectors were local people who collected taxes on behalf of the Romans. And if you remember the story of Zacchaeus, you'll probably remember that Zacchaeus made a very tidy living for himself, thank you very much, by skimming off what he was collecting from the people and handing to the Romans. And that is why the tax collectors were so despised, not just by the rulers and the religious leaders, but by the common people as well. So when we get this collection of tax collectors and sinners, what we have got here is the down in the pits, the dregs of Jewish society. And what made matters worse in the eyes of the Pharisees was that Jesus was known to have sought their friendship. He had been known to sit with them and eat with them, to share meals with them. This was just far too much altogether. This went beyond the pale. Sharing a meal was a sign of friendship. And Jesus was actually prepared to openly mix and to mingle with these people. And by doing so, in the eyes of the Pharisees, Jesus had forfeit any rights or any authority to preach about God or to teach the people. And it was to this mixed group, this mixed audience, that Jesus is telling these parables. Pharisees, tax collectors, teachers of the law, sinners. On the face of them, as I've said already, both parables appear to be very, very similar. They both tell of a search for something that is lost and then found again. And that is essentially the heart of the gospel message. We were lost to God through our sin. But God comes looking for us so that we can be found again. But perhaps that is just a little bit too simplistic. It detracts from the full meaning of what I think is actually happening here. And when we look more carefully into those parables, there's more to be found than simply a lost sheep or a lost coin. Look first at the parable of the lost sheep. Perhaps you are already familiar with the idea of the Good Shepherd from the 23rd Psalm. And here, in our parable, once again, we have the idea of a shepherd and sheep being used to explain something. Now, unlike Scotland, where grazing for sheep is plentiful, Judea was a hot, barren place where pasture is scarce. Often what pasture there was on the top of plateaus, cliffs, pardon me, surrounded by ravines and dangerous places. The sheep would be scattered over a very large area as they foraged around trying to find some food to eat. And the shepherd himself was more than likely not the actual owner of the sheep, but simply a paid labourer. Someone that was not particularly highly regarded within society. He was just given responsibility for the flock and was accountable to the owners if anything happened to that sheep. If he lost any of the flock, he was expected to actually bring the fleece of that sheep back to its owners to explain how it had been lost. Often a flock would be community owned, or there would be two or three shepherds to look after the group of sheep. And again, Barclay describes the scene of the shepherds returning back to the village after they'd been out grazing the sheep, but with the news that one of the shepherds was still out on the hill looking for one particular sheep that had been lost. And at that news, the whole of the community would then be on watch for that shepherd coming back with that valuable sheep. And when they saw him coming in on the distance with that sheep over his shoulders, they would give off a cry of joy, a cry of thanksgiving, because something that they valued was being returned to them. Now let's quickly switch to the story of the lost coin. We've got a very similar sort of story here, where a woman loses a small silver coin. And there's many ideas have been put forward as to what that particular small coin was. It might have been that that was all she had to pay for food, buy the provisions for her family. And losing that coin meant that the rest of the family would have to go hungry for the rest of the day. Perhaps it was a small coin from her headdress, the sign that she was a respectable married woman. And without that headdress, she would almost be ashamed to go out in public. Whatever the reason, it was so important for her to find that little coin that she was prepared to use up valuable lighting oil, lamp oil, in the hope that she would see that little coin glint in the darkness on the floor of her house. She swept the dark earthen floor in the hope of finding this coin. And when she does, she shouts out joyfully to her neighbours that she's found it. Celebrate with me. Two stories, one message. Why do you think Jesus told two stories which on the face of them are the same? Perhaps Jesus told the second one simply to emphasize the first one. I tend to think, however, that Jesus used the two parables very, very carefully and specifically to teach both the Pharisees that were sort of standing around pretending not to listen, but catching every single word he would have been saying, and the rest of his audience something really quite remarkable about the very nature of God himself. In the story of the shepherd, Jesus is telling us that God was prepared to become as a simple laborer, someone without great status or wealth or power. God was prepared to become someone who will care for the flock and put himself in harm's way if need be, rather than ruling from some lofty throne. And that is what we saw in Jesus. In the story of the lost coin, Jesus is telling us that God is prepared to become as one with no rights in Jewish society, just as Jewish women had no rights in the society. And again, this is what we see in Jesus, the God who became human, born in a stable and crucified like a common criminal, just so that he could come and search for us, just so that we could become reunited with God. Jesus said to them that there'll be more joy in heaven over one sinner who repents. This flew directly in the face of what the Pharisees believed. They believed and they taught that there will be joy in heaven over one sinner who is obliterated before God. A prominent Jewish scholar is reported once as conceding that this was one absolutely new thing that Jesus taught about God, that God actually searched for us. Jewish thinking was that someone could come crawling to God in self-abasement and crying for pity, and if he did that, he might just be able to find it. But he would never have conceived of a God who actually went out looking for those who were lost, those who had fallen away. And this new insight into the very nature of God is the very foundation of the gospel message. And it's summed up, I believe, so perfectly by the Apostle Paul in this letter to Timothy, where he says, "Here is a trustworthy saying that deserves full acceptance. Christ Jesus came into the world to save sinners." Jesus himself said, "For the Son of Man came to seek and to save what was lost." And I'm going to repeat that. "For the Son of Man came to seek and to save what was lost." My friends, our God is not locked away in some faraway mystical place. Our God is not vengeful, demanding jihad or sacrifice or blind, unquestioning obedience. Our God is right here. Our God is right here in our church, in our homes, and in our workplace. And he's searching for us, each and every one of us, just like the shepherd went looking for the sheep. He's turning the place upside down, trying to find us. And when he does find us, all heaven rejoices. Why? Because God considers that we are worth it. We're worth the bother. We were his, and then we wandered off to do our own thing. But when God finds us, and we allow ourselves to be rescued, allow ourselves to be found, all heaven rejoices. That is how much we mean to God. How great is that? So let me come back to the question that I asked at the start of this morning's sermon. How do we think others see us as individuals within the church? As a valuable painting, perhaps by Van Gogh, good looking, attracting lots of attention, worth a lot of money? Or rather as a ragged collection of tired looking, scruffy individual articles? here's the good news. Whatever, to God, we are all of great value, great worth, worth the sacrifice he made to come and find us. Amen.